Hey, hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Adulski. You got my co-host, Dr. Carl. He's just a regular endocrinologist because today we have the amazing Dr. Lucky Sikkon, who is a reproductive endocrinologist. She has a book called, what is it, The Lucky Egg?
The Lucky Egg. I had to do it.
That's great. And you know, it's an interesting way she got on this. I had a patient just recently asking me about fertility and GLP-1 medicines, and they're going to go through the whole fertility process. And they're like, you know, do you have anybody you recommend? I'm like, I'm friends with a couple reproductive endocrinologists. Like, what about this Lucky Egg book? And I'm like, let me look it up. I was just like looking it up online while talking to her. I'm like, I haven't heard of this doctor. Let me just make sure she's legit. And I saw that Dr. Jen Gunter, our friend who's been on the podcast, an OBGYN, followed her, and I messaged her. I'm like, hey, she cool? And she was like, oh yeah, she's legit. And I'm like, okay, we're good. Quite frankly, you're going online, you never know what you're going to get. Yeah. So then I messaged her, and Dr. Jen did a little message chat to the group.
I'm so glad that I passed the sniff test.
And Spencer likes to sniff.
No, definitely sniffing. Lots of sniffing going on. So we were like, you know what? And it's timely because I also messaged Dr. Lucky about, I get so many questions about the GLP-1 medicines during fertility and in like the guy. We'll go over some of this stuff, but that was the reason we had you on. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you. And I feel like I have to be honest and disclose that I actually don't lift. So I feel like I snuck through the cracks that I'm one of the guests on this Docs Who Lift podcast. I know I need to. It's like on my list of resolutions. So this is a good reminder.
Keep it simple. Keep it just consistent. Yeah. Don't overcomplicate it. Consistency over.
I've just entered my 40s and I'm like, what am I doing? I need to be doing weight bearing exercise. Anyway, I digress.
Every little bit's good.
We'll get you going. So welcome to the, you're from Canada.
Yeah.
You started off there and then somehow came to the States for training.
Yes. There wasn't a well-defined path for reproductive endocrinology in Canada. And also, I hate to say it, but they do a 5-year OBGYN residency, and I had to factor that into my decision-making, one less year of residency here in the States. So I just was like, you know I want to go into this field. I was very passionate about it, and it just felt like a more defined path in the States. And so it wasn't easy because I wasn't a citizen. Eventually, I married someone who is, so that worked out well, and I became an official citizen in 2021. But trying to match into residency when you need a visa, even as a Canadian, you'd think that that border isn't like a real border, but it really is a huge disadvantage because depending on what visa you get, it determines like, do you have to like sign a contract saying you're going to return to your country after. It was very limiting. So I was really happy to get an H-1B visa and become a citizen and stay. And I'm really happy in New York.
You know, you mentioned the pathway to get to your point. And I think that might be helpful to learn about that, because I don't think a lot of people out there know all of our pathways. You know, so for general endocrinology, like what I did, you know, graduated med school, went to 3 years of internal medicine residency. Between that and endocrine fellowship, I did my obesity board certification and then a couple of years of endocrinology fellowship. But that's very different than reproductive endocrinology. So tell everyone how that goes.
Yeah. So the first step is after medical school, you go into OBGYN residency. And that's kind of a trip, because for someone like me who knew I wanted to go into the field of fertility medicine and reproductive health, you know, you had to do everything. So I learned how to deliver babies. I, you know, learned how to manage gynecologic cancers. And there's just such a wide variety of issues. Like OBGYN is such a broad field. I don't know if you guys relate to this, but I remember that was always the hardest clinical rotation in medical school, because the amount of knowledge you'd have to pack into that one rotation, it's like it really could be two different specialties. So you do that, and then you go into reproductive endocrinology and infertility fellowship, which is like a mini master's, mini PhD, because one whole year is research, and then 2 years are clinical. And that's where you really learn how to properly, safely stimulate people's ovaries for egg retrievals, whether they're doing IVF or egg freezing, and you learn all the intricacies of the reproductive hormones.
Yeah, it's very different than what I do. Although I work with a lot of reproductive endocrinologists because there's so much overlap and we have to help each other out, but it's definitely a different thing.
Gynecologists, they're surgeons, you know, too. So people don't understand that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had to learn how to do like 13-hour cancer debulking surgeries. And now the extent of the procedures I do, it's like a 15-minute egg retrieval that's really an aspiration with a needle. It's not doing any incisions. And, you know, embryo transfers take like 5 to 10 minutes. So it's a crazy path to get here.
Interesting.
Wow. Yeah. And academic, apparently.
Yes. Yes.
I don't think I knew that part. Very cool. What made you want to write this book then?
Well, I think, you know, it was very organic. I definitely, in medical school and in my training, was never someone that envisioned myself on social media. I don't know if you can relate to that. This was something that kind of felt thrust upon me because during the pandemic, I was pregnant. As an REI, we stopped doing any cycles. Any elective care was really suspended in New York City for like a good 3-4 months. And I had to find a way to connect with people and do my part to help, but also stay safe in my situation. So that's when I really forced myself out of my comfort zone. That one thing led to another, because then it was like, okay, now COVID's kind of dying down and I can get off my soapbox talking about how the vaccine doesn't cause infertility. But you know what? That was super effective. Now I'm realizing this is an effective tool and there's so much other BS in my field. And a lot of people are not on the same page about like giving people steroids and blood thinners and all the supplements. And, you know, I just found myself so frustrated with that and having these individual conversations with my patients about all this misinformation that was leading them off of their path. So I started using social media to combat that, and I'm still doing that. But then you get frustrated with that because you're like, okay, now I'm getting all these DMs being like, do you have a post on this? And there's no index. I was like, you know, I would love to do it. I started thinking about it in 2023, 2024, but I was like, oh God, I have like way too much on my plate. I have 2 young children. Like I'd love to do it, but I don't know when and how. And then it all came together because my book agent found me. She's someone who is going through infertility and consuming all of my information, looking for books, being in the world of books and getting frustrated that there wasn't a fertility guidebook written by a fertility doctor that was evidence-based, that was not reading like a textbook. And she felt like I could do it. And so she reached out to someone she saw follows me that she knows. And in a roundabout way, we got connected and the rest is history. And it was actually beautiful because she became my patient. She found out she was pregnant the week I found out I got a book deal. I handed in my manuscript the weekend she had her baby. It's like,
wow.
It's like a Hallmark movie.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's great. Yeah. Congrats. That's great. What are you finding are the biggest like myths around of the fertility world? I mean, I see
apparently the vaccines.
I see all sorts of stuff, but I'm always like, oh, I'm not the REI here.
Yeah. I think the one that really hits home and gets a lot of people's attention because it's one of the hardest things that I deal with as a fertility expert are any and all claims that you can reverse the biological clock. That, you know, doctors are all hiding something from you because they have a vested interest in you needing their help. So I, on the other hand, this wellness guru, know about these smoothies or these teas or these tinctures that will make your eggs young again. That is like number one, you know, and it's sad because really smart, educated people that you'd think would never fall for this. It's like, you know, you're just in a very vulnerable spot and you want to believe anything and everything that could make you feel hopeful. And there's a lot of fertility coaches. Like I posted something today about someone DM'd me saying, this woman who's not a fertility doctor, you know, she did a free session with me and she said, you know, she charges $1,500 for 3 months. I don't know what service she could be providing. It's not even clear from looking at her profile, but she claims to have a 96% client pregnancy success rate. And I said, the fact that she called you a client is the first red flag, right? There's just a lot of people that act like they have the know-how and expertise, and it's very evil. I often wonder to myself, how do these people sleep at night? Like you're really preying on a population that's desperate and vulnerable. And that just makes it easier to manipulate them, especially when it comes to something like fertility, which is time sensitive. So on top of the distress of feeling like your body's not doing what it was meant to be doing, and it's such a sensitive thing to want to have children and to not be able to also feel like there's this hourglass in the background and the sands are just kind of running through it and you're running out of time. It's a very easy way to get manipulated.
How did they sleep on a pile of money? That's how they...
It's amazing how it transcends the specialties. I mean, it's every what you just specialty. Described is exactly the same thing kind of for all of us. I mean, you know, in my world, it's, you know, not only the obesity and diabetes stuff, but the thyroid. Of course, they always have tinctures and stuff. Like you said, they're always somehow going to fix the thyroid. That's somehow a secret that we're all keeping from them. And all these
don't
always
you
things.
Find it?
Think about the cancer world. It happens in oncology. That's horrible.
I know.
But they make way more money than we'll ever make. Or at least they have millions of followers. I got peanuts.
What's wrong with us? Why do we have a moral compass?
I know.
I could be on a yacht right
scruples.
Now.
Yeah. It's called scruples. I think it's a good thing. I mean,
I know.
That's all you got. That's why I left.
I just don't know how they derive meaning in their day-to-day job when like that's what your business plan rests on is fooling other people to do things that are bad for them. It's terrible. Yeah.
Without getting into like giving away all the secret sauce of your book, like what are your?
I'll give it away. I don't care.
What are the main points of your book? Like, do you go through like the process and talk through it, and do you give like your best tips of like this is going to give you the best shot to become pregnant and
It's not like a prescriptive, this is the formula everyone has to follow, because I think that in and of itself is a red flag, right? Everyone has an individual confluence of factors that are coming together, and there's different types of challenges. So what it really is it's a fertility Bible so that anyone coming from any angle and any place in their life with any type of problem can look at this and go to they can either read it from cover to cover, which is what I would recommend, obviously, because I think that's when you're really going to get the most out of it. But if you don't have time to do that, you could also just go straight to the index and find your problem and also understand the basics and then maybe like some things that you should be considering and understanding what the evidence shows, because that was the whole purpose of this, was in a sea of misinformation, drowning out the noise for people and saying, this is what you actually need to care about, because I'm someone that actually helps people get pregnant and overcome infertility. And I'm here to tell you these things don't matter and these things actually do. And as a result, I think when someone reads it, they're going to feel calmer. They're going to feel way more in control in a process that is largely out of your control, hence the name of my book, The Lucky Egg. It's not just a pun. It's the truth. You know, everyone knows people that have had multiple failed rounds of IVF. Maybe they even went down the surrogacy path, like really difficult cases. And then, I ovulated between cycles and got pregnant. Or, you know, people that struggled when they were younger and then at 44 randomly get pregnant. Like these things happen. And I think that that's the thing that has allowed a wedge to be driven between patients and doctors and clinics and the people that actually understand the evidence, is that when these things happen that defy the statistics, it's very hard for people to logically understand that, right? And it's very easy then to say, well, what did you do? What did you do to get pregnant at 44? Oh, you were taking that supplement. Okay, now I'm going to shout from the roof.
Special tea that you were drinking.
Right. It's that people haven't been trained to critically think. And it's not their job to be trained in that way. That was our job, right? But it's very easy to have this like magical thinking. So this book, basically the first quarter or third of it is, what is the fertility knowledge gap? Because in order to rectify a problem, you have to identify what the problem is, and it's huge. Most people that walk through my door come in knowing very little about their body, and that is a problem because it leaves them vulnerable to all these scams, right? And then it goes deeper into, okay, now here are the parameters of when you should seek care. How do you find a clinic and a doctor? And what's really opaque to a lot of people is, What is a good doctor? Like, first of all, a lot of people don't even realize they need to see more than their OBGYN. They should go to an REI. There are some places where OBGYNs are kind of acting as REIs, but they don't have the same level of training. So I give a lot of like inside tips, like here is how you kind of judge the success rates of a clinic. Here's where you can go to a third-party website and how do you interpret the success rates? And how do you suss out whether the clinic that you're considering doing your treatment at is evidence-based? Because there's a lot of variation. Even within New York City, in the quality of the care that is provided. Some people are still putting in 3 or 4 embryos at a time. And some people, like myself, are like, no, we're doing single embryo transfers because the data shows that that is lower risk and you're not compromising on success rates. So it's really about pointing people in the right direction and giving them the tools that these are facts that you don't find easily online. And then it gets deeper into the complexities of, okay, now if you're struggling, here are the tests that are evidence-based, here are the treatments that are evidence-based, and here's how you figure out that path. There's a lot of decision trees. There's also, and I don't know how I fit this all in like 100,000 words or less, chapters devoted to same-sex couples because there isn't a guidebook for them or people that are navigating using donor egg, donor sperm, or surrogacy. There's also troubleshooting. This is where I think the meat of the book is for people that have tried all the treatments and they don't know why it's not working. They're often the ones that are doing all of these crazy add-ons or adding, you know, all these immunosuppressive drugs and things that really aren't rooted in evidence and could have potential harms. And there are many clinics promoting these things because I think that some clinics and some doctors, unfortunately, these are my colleagues, are leaning into that human nature need or tendency to want to have the Band-Aid. Like, it feels good to have tools in your toolkit, right? It never feels good to tell a patient, listen, we've done all the tests and we cannot find the answer. Mm-hmm. We don't know why this didn't work a third time. So there is this tendency for people to be like, well, maybe it's your blood clotting. Maybe it's your natural killer cells. And let's try this. Let's just try that. And it's very wishy-washy. And patients are smart. They don't feel good about that. They're like, why didn't we do all this from the get-go if this is what you think my problem is, right? So I think just helping people to really understand logically, like, here's the sequence of steps, and this is what's evidence-based, and this is how to minimize harms. And it's not promised to get you pregnant quickly. It's not promised to do anything magical like reverse your biological clock. But I do promise that it gives you the information you really need to avoid wasting time and to understand what the right next step should be.
So what, could you talk about, and it's presumably some of it's in your book, but just so people understand, how do we and why do we define like infertility to some degree and the time frames and stuff? And then some of the most common causes that we can evaluate and find in addition to when we don't really know and then you're doing a lot of the stuff that you do.
Yes. So a lot of people come to me and say, I want to just check everything out. I'm not even trying. Can you tell me if I'm fertile? And the punchline is, no, you have to try to know, right? Human reproduction is extremely inefficient. We are the most inefficient when you compare us to other, you know, animals and species. We ovulate one egg per cycle in the majority of cases. That egg is fleeting. It lasts for only 12 to 24 hours. If it's not fertilized in that time frame, too bad. Then you have to wait for the next cycle. If you're lucky enough to be a person that has a regular period, which not everyone does, then you wait for the next month to go by and you hope to, you know, be able to try within a window of opportunity of 2 to 5 days leading up to ovulation. Even if you time everything perfectly, not every egg is going to accept every sperm fertilizing it. So that's a complex set of reactions. And even when we try to force that to happen in the setting of an IVF lab, it's like 70 to 80% of eggs will fertilize. From there, only like half of them will turn into an embryo, which is a process that takes a week. And not every embryo that forms will be genetically normal because it's not like, this is a common misconception, it's not like your brain, your pituitary sends a signal to the ovary and it's a selection process like American Idol, like based on merit. It's random like a lottery. So even in your 20s, someone can have a miscarriage because their body ovulated an egg that had errors in it. Yes, even in your 20s, your eggs aren't perfect, right? And that problem crops up even more so over time as we age. The proportion of eggs that would turn into unhealthy embryos that don't have what it takes to implant or stay implanted increases and becomes an overwhelming majority as we enter our 40s. So when we tell people, okay, you're under 35, especially in your 20s and very early 30s, maybe try for up to a year. That's okay, because each cycle, when you only release one egg, that egg is a long shot, and we need to normalize that concept. And at best in your 20s, there's a 20% chance that it's going to jump through all those hoops. It's like pulling the lever of a slot machine and hoping for everything to line up. You have to play to win, right? And you have to maybe be persistent to win. And you just need to know when to hold them and when to fold them. going with the gambling analogy. So I would say, you know, it's permissible to try for up to a year if you have regular cycles and no fertility red flags. Now, if you're someone who knows you have PCOS, fibroids, endometriosis, these are all conditions that can have a strong predisposition towards infertility. So if you have any concerns, don't wait a whole year. I've had patients come to me who are like, I only get a period once every 5 months, and we've been trying for a year. You know, if you're not ovulating, you're not in the game, go straight to the doctor. Now, if you're 35 and older because of the biological clock, you want to get the show on the road faster. So we say, don't wait longer than 6 months. And in your 40s, we say, don't wait longer than 3 months. And when I say don't wait longer, this means to go see a reproductive endocrinologist, infertility expert like myself. And the first step is testing. Now, the tests are, just simply put, checking your eggs, your fallopian tubes, your uterus, and your sperm, right? These are the four components that you need to make a baby. For the eggs, the only thing I'm able to evaluate is how many eggs do you have, which doesn't ultimately tell me anything about your fertility because you only release one egg when you ovulate. But it's nice to know, because when we think about more complex treatment options like IVF, the more eggs that I see at the surface of the ovary, the more eggs I have to work with. And that can definitely make me feel more confident about treatment, and also helps me understand what's the right regimen to use if I'm going to go that route and stimulate your ovaries. But other than that, the main thing we look at is, are you someone that can ovulate regularly, right? So there are those hormone blood tests and just understanding from your history what your cycle looks like. There's a test called an HSG, a hysterosalpingogram, which is like an X-ray of your pelvis. Dye is put through a speculum into the reproductive tract, and we watch it spill through either tube. It's a bit of a crampy test. There are some pain control options, so always talk to the radiologist or your doctor about that. And it will highlight the inner lining of the uterus and the fallopian tubes. So that's like a two-for-one test. It will highlight if there's blocked tubes. If you have blocked tubes because of endometriosis, you had a ruptured appendix when you were younger. Like, those are some of the risk factors. Then that tells us, okay, we need to work around the blockage, and IVF is one of those options. If you have fibroids in the inner lining of the uterus, that's taking up real estate. That's something we need to rectify before we, you know, say, okay, go ahead and try to get pregnant, or let's do a treatment to try to help you get pregnant. And it all depends on the location and the size. Sperm is a big one, and I shouldn't have left it to the last, because that's what a lot of couples do. Both partners should be getting tested concurrently. 50% of infertility cases involve a male factor. And, you know, sometimes there's a combination of cases. A third of cases will involve just a male factor alone. And depending on how things are looking with the concentration of the sperm, how much of the sample is swimming in a forward direction and shaped normally, that's going to help determine, you know, what treatment options we have available. Really severe cases where there's only like a small handful of sperm in a milliliter of the sample, you can overcome that by doing IVF and injecting one sperm directly into each egg. But if it's less, you know, of a severe case, there's options like injecting sperm at the top of the uterus. It's a procedure that takes about 5 minutes, but it's like sperm delivery. You're getting the sperm closer to where it needs to go. And a lot of times this workup may come back completely normal. And in those cases, I always ask myself, does this person have endometriosis? Because that doesn't always show up on imaging, right? And that can be really insidious. And a lot of women normalize their pain or haven't been taken seriously, and it takes a long time to get diagnosed. And that could be like a subtle thing that I think about if none of the test results come back. Insulin resistance is another one, and I know we're going to talk about that. I think a lot of people are walking around with insulin resistance who have no idea. And I think sometimes it's put on their radar because it's tested, or someone mentions, hey, you know, your A1C is your hemoglobin A1C, a measure of sugar control over the last 90 days. It's creeping up. It's on the higher end. You're in the pre-diabetic range. Yet it won't be addressed. They'll say, okay, just diet, you know, and all of these like really laid back measures. But as a reproductive endocrinologist, I tend to err on the side of diagnosing, having a low threshold to call it and say, yes, you might be insulin resistant, and treating it, because it can affect egg quality, ovulation, and the ability for an embryo to implant and stay implanted.
Okay, we're going to get into that, I guess. What about these places that are saying, you got to test your AMH?
Yeah, so AMH is just the egg count, right? AMH is a blood test, anti-Müllerian hormone. And I did allude to it because I said, all I can tell you about your ovaries are how many eggs are available if and should you need to do an egg retrieval to freeze your eggs or do IVF. And obviously, more helps you respond better. And the more I have to work with, the happier I am about it, right? But that's all your AMH is going to tell you. AMH is going to tell you the same thing as what we see on the ultrasound, which is just counting how many bubbles of fluid, they're called follicles, that each contain an egg. That represents a very limited subset of the total number of eggs, but those are the ones that I can get to. Your body's always recruiting waves of eggs from the locked pantries deep in the core of each ovary. And it's, I say pantry because it's like a rationing. The earlier in life you are and the more eggs you have in your stockpile, because you're not making new eggs or repairing your eggs over time. That's the biological clock, right? The more eggs you have, the more you bring to the surface and waste each month. The less eggs you have, especially later in life, the fewer you bring. And those bubbles of fluid that each contain an egg that we're counting on ultrasound is going to correlate with your AMH level in your blood work, because AMH is a hormone that's produced by all the little cells called granulosa cells that line those bubbles. So it's like not new information, but I like getting an AMH level for my purposes when I'm stimulating someone's ovaries. It helps me make dosing decisions. But does it tell me about your fertility? No. I've seen patients with very, very low AMH levels who still have enough eggs to be able to ovulate one egg per month, and they get pregnant. Like, it's not a problem. It was only flagged or checked because they came in considering things like egg freezing. And then I get an email from them, you know, they freaked out about their low AMH, and I explained to them, it's not indicative of your egg quality or your ability to get pregnant. Many studies, well-designed studies, have shown that. But it's very hard to uncouple. People feel like their bodies are broken and that they're in menopause just because their egg count's low. As long as you have enough eggs to actually ovulate, it's not a problem. But I do treat it seriously. If I see someone who's young with a low AMH, I will do additional testing to look for genetic predispositions. Now, this is getting really detailed, like things like the fragile X mutation. I look for potential organic causes of people going into menopause early, because if I could catch that early in a 20-something year old, maybe that would change the calculus of whether she freezes her eggs, right?
So probably the takeaway is, like, maybe not go to these random online places, and you should probably talk this.
Yes.
I thought you were going to say their takeaway is that you got to have intercourse multiple times a day forever.
Only during that a certain time of the month. Apparently,
you just got to do it all the time.
Two to five days.
So my question, because obviously in my world, I see, you know, we have so much overlap. So yeah. I see a lot of young adult females, certainly a lot of PCOS being the most common endocrine disorder in young adult females. And, you know, when it does get into a more of a fertility discussion, bam, they're getting sent to you. Mm-hmm. So like for PCOS diagnosis, you know, that's a lot of the times what I need to do. You know, we have to make sure their thyroid's not an issue. They don't have congenital adrenal hyperplasia, prolactin stuff. And of course, I'm sometimes needing to look if they have more severe symptoms like for Cushing's and whatnot. Now, I know AMH is, you know, it's in the conversation of that diagnosis. I don't tend to use it because clinically with everything else, I just don't need to. And plus, I'm doing a lot of the cardiometabolic stuff. I'm getting their 2-hour glucose tolerance test. I'd be interested in how you do that. But do you, I assume you've got to get a lot of PCOS patients where you actually make the diagnosis, because they get to you first.
Oh,
and you're looking for everything.
Yes.
And so does the AMH help you at all in that regard? It's just kind of interesting to me as a, you know, doing that stuff myself, and I'm not being convinced totally yet by the
data. So I've only kind of talked to you guys about AMH in the context of differentiating normal ovarian reserve versus is it lower? And the only reason I care about that is that it dictates how well you might respond to this artificial process of stimulating the ovaries to try to extract eggs, right? You're right that the extreme other end, where the AMH is extraordinarily high, a normal level is relative to age. You know, there was one study of 17,000 just controls, people that weren't even diagnosed with infertility, where they tested AMH levels. And there's a huge standard deviation, but there's kind of like means and, you know, ranges that are normal per age. So what's normal for a 40-year-old is not normal for a 20-year-old and vice versa. But in general, people kind of think of above one as like normal. So when you see sometimes patients with PCOS may come in with an AMH of 10, that's like off the charts high. I've seen like 17, that's extraordinarily high. And you go to look at their ovaries on the ultrasound and you see so many follicles crammed together. And usually they're in this peripheral distribution, this pattern that we call string of pearls, right? And we don't really quite understand the mechanism. There have been lots of interesting molecular biology studies done at the level of the AMH receptor, finding receptor defects. So maybe like the AMH is not able to bind the receptor properly, and therefore, you know, you have to have higher levels to compensate for that. We don't really know, but we know that women with PCOS, for whatever reason, have a tendency to recruit many more eggs from the stockpile. And they're crammed in there and they're arranged in a really specific pattern a lot of the time. And so naturally, I already told you, AMH and the number of follicles kind of goes hand in hand. So they tend to have very high AMH levels. Now, I don't use that as a diagnostic tool. It's been suggested that levels of 4.5 and above might be a flag. And of course, if someone's AMH comes back high, I'm like, oh yeah, that looks very PCOS-like, but it's not part of the diagnostic criteria. I use something called the Rotterdam criteria, mm-hmm. which is...
Which I went there, by the way.
Oh, you did?
But, yeah, I was there about 12 years ago. Remember, Spencer, when I went there? When I was still in the Navy. I went with this congressional thing because they needed a doctor when I was in the Navy to go with these six congressmen. And I went to Rotterdam, and it was, of course, right after fellowship. I was like, ah! I was going crazy.
Was everyone there obsessed with PCOS?
That's what I thought, and it turns out they weren't. They didn't. I kept asking everyone. They didn't know what I was talking about.
And then they're like, "We need a doctor," and he's like, "I'm not. You want to ask me?"
Well, it's a really simple way to think about it, and I think that I err on the side of ruling people in for a diagnosis versus missing the diagnosis, right? Because what I do is so time sensitive, so. I like the Rotterdam criteria because you only need two out of three of the following to say someone has PCOS. Irregular cycles, right? That tells you their ovulation is likely irregular. Polycystic appearing ovaries, which I just described how they look. And then either signs or symptoms or lab values that are suggestive of overactivity of testosterone or high levels of testosterone or testosterone-like hormones like DHEA. And that can cause, you know, acne, hair growth where it's not supposed to traditionally be for women, and male pattern baldness. And two out of three, you meet the diagnosis, and you have to exclude other potential things that could be masquerading themselves as PCOS. So adrenal issues, thyroid, you test prolactin levels. And with that, it's very easy to rule in for the diagnosis. And I can't even tell you the number of patients that I've said, hey, I'm the first person telling you definitively you have PCOS. And they're like, but I've talked about this with my OBGYN and with this other doctor, and they're all saying that I don't technically rule in for the diagnosis. So I think, you know, there's a lot of confusion, and it's sad because it's an easily treatable problem. Like, it's an easy to treat problem. If your issue is you're having trouble getting pregnant and your cycles are irregular, we use oral medications that basically fool your brain into thinking there's not enough estrogen, so your pituitary freaks out a little, sends a stronger signal, because the problem of PCOS with irregular ovulation is that your ovaries are stubborn and resistant to those signals. So if you make the signal louder, often you can get through to the ovary and make someone ovulate and get them back in the game, because if you're not ovulating, you're not in the game. I really want to put that on a t-shirt.
Mm-hmm. That'd be a great t-shirt.
Yeah.
The lucky egg, and if you're not ovulating, you're not in the game.
I want to wear that t-shirt and go visit Rotterdam.
Yeah. It was a cool place.
So this goes into the whole GLP-1 thing, because I have had patients that clearly have PCOS. They have period every like 3 or 4 months, mm-hmm. or they don't have them at all.
Yeah.
They start tirzepatide, Zepbound, or Mounjaro, depending on the person. Mm-hmm. And without losing any weight, their periods start again, mm-hmm. with a GLP-1, and they're not even losing much weight, but they become regular.
Yeah.
Now I have, you may have some insight into some more of the biological mechanisms that are going on there. I assume it has something to do with helping the communication between the hypothalamus, pituitary, and the ovaries, something going on there. But besides that pathophysiology or biology, mm-hmm. the guidance is to stop these medicines 2 months prior to trying to conceive. Now we're seeing a lot of Zepbound, Ozempic, Wegovy babies, Mounjaro yes. babies. So people are clearly becoming pregnant while on these. But
yeah.
if there's a, what are you seeing? Are you seeing a lot of people on these medicines become pregnant? And what are you seeing of the outcomes of this? And I know the animal data shows, there were some concerns in the animal data, but human mm-hmm. data so far is not showing any signal for harm.
Yeah, in the case of animal data and toxicology studies, which we have to take seriously, a lot of times they're testing at doses that are so toxic, you know, like it's not really applicable to what the situation is when humans are taking it therapeutically. So I think, you know, it's scary to be the first wave of people having Ozempic babies, but I think with each of these cases, we're gaining more information. And that's just kind of how it goes when it comes to research on a lot of drugs, when it comes to research on drugs in pregnancy. When you think about like all the antidepressants and, you know, 10 years ago, there were meds that people were very afraid to allow pregnant women to continue. And now we're like, well, actually, the risk-benefit calculus sways towards controlling your mental health issues. And there are certain drugs that are better studied than others. But it's impossible ethically a lot of the times to do the necessary clinical trials. So it just might be like a natural thing that we eventually gain more comfort and it becomes a different recommendation. But right now, we just don't have that safety data to say to everyone, continue. I'll explain the mechanism of how I think that it works, right?
I'd love to hear it.
Obviously, with weight loss, for people that can benefit from losing weight, anytime you're losing weight, especially adipose, central adiposity, like fat around the midsection, tends to be very correlated with insulin resistance. These drugs don't just reduce your resistance to insulin by weight loss. You know, they also just are insulin sensitizing agents like metformin is, but it's like a stronger version of metformin. And these drugs can help women with PCOS or insulin resistance. A lot of women with PCOS have insulin resistance. So let's just talk about insulin resistance, right? What that is a tendency for, just like I said, the ovaries are resistant to the signal from the brain. The cells in your peripheral body, your cells, your tissues are resistant to the effects of insulin, which is a hormone that essentially acts like a key that unlocks cells and allows sugar to go from the bloodstream and be stored effectively into the cells. And if you're resistant, then your body's going to churn out more insulin from your pancreas because it's like, oh, the blood sugar is still not controlled. Insulin actually acts like a growth factor on the ovaries and can cause the ovaries to overproduce testosterone. Now, a lot of people aren't even aware that the ovaries make testosterone, but they do. And when that becomes something that gets to an excess point, first of all, testosterone gets converted in fat cells to estrogen. And your pituitary is sending signals to the ovary, but it's also sending signals to the ovary and waiting for signals back. And one of those signals are hormones like estrogen and progesterone. And so when it's detecting these higher levels of estrogen, it's getting confused. And so it's messing up the signaling even more. And so it's this vicious cycle that can make your cycles really irregular. And I already said, if you're not ovulating, you're not in the game. So now people take medications, lifestyle changes, whatever they're doing that's addressing the insulin resistance is kind of correcting that vicious cycle and saying, okay, I'm quieting down the insulin that now it's having less of an effect on the ovaries. There's less of an imbalance in the testosterone, you know, that shouldn't be produced in excess in the ovaries. And now the signals are getting through more readily and everything kind of gets restored. And so that's what's happening. When people are going on these meds, they're starting to ovulate. And sometimes, you know, their ovulation being irregular was the main issue. And the minute that they start ovulating, like sometimes people don't even realize that they ovulated because it wasn't like they started getting their periods. It's like the first time they ovulated, they got pregnant, which is pretty lucky when you think of the statistics. But, you know, a lot of times I say, yes, but I always say like PCOS is one of the easiest problems to treat, particularly in younger patients, because you're like, oh, clear target to treat. Let's fix this. And now we get you back in the game and it'll happen. Usually, you know, rather quickly. So it's a wonderful drug. And it's something that I think is difficult for people to navigate because they're getting this advice about being off of it. But I still think there can be a benefit. I think it's important for people to know their contraception may not work as effectively with certain forms, because if you slow gastric emptying and you're taking oral contraception, that could have an effect. And so if you're not wanting to be pregnant and you're on these drugs, it's important to just be aware of that fact. If you're kind of ambivalent about it and you're like, oh, I'll never get pregnant anyway because I never ovulate and you're taking these drugs, it's important to realize that it might change the fact that you never ovulate. And if you're trying to get pregnant, sometimes depending on your case and your age and your timeline, it may be beneficial to take a stint. And if this is a medication that can help you because all of the other lifestyle measures and things you've tried haven't been enough, that might be worthwhile to say, okay, I'm going to take this for, you know, 3 to 6 months and really try to get like tuned up, so to speak. But a lot of times I'll have patients transition from GLP-1s to metformin, where we have a lot more data on the effects of metformin in pregnancy and a lot of comfort and experience around it. So I don't just kind of like say, okay, you're going to go off of it and we're not going to address insulin resistance, because I do think there's a benefit to addressing it. And I think this is more of an issue for people that are continuing to try on their own or doing treatment options like inseminations, where it's like month after month and you don't know how long of a runway it's going to take till you get to that pregnancy. And so you don't want to backslide and lose all the progress that you made, right? I think for IVF, I actually have a very, very specific plan. I say continue your GLP-1 and stop it, you know, when we start the shots for the egg retrieval, because that's like a week and a half or two weeks. The concern is that we don't want it in your system for the anesthesia for the egg retrieval, right? And now a lot of the anesthesiologists say even being off of it for a week is fine. You get the egg retrieval procedure done, simple procedure, and then you can stay off of it because it's going to take another 2 weeks to get your period. And then if you're going straight into an embryo transfer, continue to stay off of it. That takes like 3 weeks to prep. Then we're doing the transfer, and then it takes like a week to really have a pregnancy established. There you go. That's 8 weeks, right? So I'm like, take it right up until this, and then let's just like go through the steps right away and get you pregnant. And I know that might sound crazy to someone who's not familiar, but IVF works really well now. It's not a guaranteed to work on the first try, but if you have a genetically healthy tested embryo, there's about a 60 to 70% chance of live birth from the first transfer. And within three successive embryo transfers using one embryo at a time, 3 months in a row, if it takes that many tries to get there, 92% live birth rate cumulatively. So I think that that kind of is a easier, cleaner way to handle GLP-1s while conceiving, but not everyone's doing IVF. And so I tend to transition people onto that
hormone. I was going to ask you, so like, yeah, this is what the patients will say. They're like, they've lost 30% of their weight, let's say.
Yeah.
And they've never, they're so worried about gaining their weight back. And I say, well, the guidance from a medical legal standpoint, I don't think that anything biologically would be wrong with them continuing it, but I have to give that guidance because if something goes wrong, and I was the one that said,
absolutely, that I'm on the hook,
but like, it is frustrating for the patient because they're just like, man, I don't want to backslide. And if they do backslide, it could be worsening their fertility going backwards.
Yeah.
So I didn't know if you had, if you were ever like, you know what, the benefits outweigh the risk. If you started playing cowboy
I'm not
yet,
there yet,
cowgirl,
no.
I don't know what you'd go
no,
by.
No, well, I'm not there yet.
Here's a question. Okay. You know, so you talk about how we'll accumulate data because of this. In my world, I know about say bromocriptine and cabergoline and prolactinomas, and that's how we found out that those were safe for the exact same reason that you're talking about. Now, interestingly, exenatide I think is the most well-studied GLP in PCOS, for example, just because it's the oldest one.
That was liraglutide
over 20 years. Fine. Well, exenatide and then liraglutide have been studied. I know there. It's just interesting. I just saw a table with tons of studies in exenatide. So that makes me wonder, because I don't know this part, is have those older GLPs been at all shown to improve fertility or anything like that specifically? Could they improve like PCOS stuff? You know, they improve menstrual cycles and whatever, but actual conception rates, fertility, because I'm not even so sure, and you tell me, the newer ones haven't necessarily been shown to even improve the outcomes of IVF per se yet. Is that right?
No, we don't have that data.
There's a siren going on, by the way.
I'm sorry.
They're taking you. The left.
They're taking you away.
Do we want to wait, let it pass?
No, it's fine. Go ahead.
Okay. Welcome to my life. I'm like sometimes like having such like in-depth, intense conversations with patients, and there's like all of this noise in the background. We don't have a lot of information on IVF outcomes. I think it's going to emerge because I think now more and more REIs like myself are saying to patients, I think that this might actually be the most time-sensitive approach, right? For people that are struggling with their weight, we know that excess weight, obesity is correlated with worse treatment outcomes with IVF and lower implantation rates. And that's a very delicate subject to broach with patients. But if someone is in their 40s and they've made one or two normal embryos, and we want to give them the best chance of success and also optimize their health going into pregnancy, does it make sense for me to say, okay, just go and try to lose the weight? You know, it's like, well, thanks. I've heard that advice my whole life. It's like, no, I'm going to try and optimize things as efficiently as possible, because I'm also weighing it against the risk of, well, what if we wait 6 months or 12 months and then I find out at 41 or 42, oh, these embryos didn't implant, then you're starting from scratch. And I really worry about the biological clock. So there's always this nagging thing in the back of my mind as a fertility expert, you know, am I doing right by the patient? You know, the enemy of good is better. Is that the saying? Like sometimes you do just have to call it, even if someone isn't at their ideal weight. And, you know, you optimize them as much as you possibly can, but we also at some point have to move forward. So I do love GLP-1s because it allows me to feel like I'm being as aggressive as possible in that optimization in the shortest window of time possible, if that makes sense.
So you're telling me good, better, best.
Good, better, best. Until, she doesn't
until,
know.
Until your good gets she's better and your better gets best.
She's yeah. She's in New York. She doesn't know. But good, better, best.
We're Bears fans.
Spencer Cox with the Bears. I went to college with the head coach.
I'm just trying to keep up.
Yeah. No, very cool. So now that answers a question. So the interesting thing, I was going to go into some of the, so GLP-1s by themselves aren't insulin sensitizing, but GLP-1/GIP, so mm-hmm. tirzepatide specifically,
yes.
as, and I don't know, maybe my brother has seen this. I don't particularly see as much of, so what I was talking about, tirzepatide specifically is when they get their cycles back without weight loss. I'm not sure I've seen that as much on Ozempic, Wegovy. So maybe
I feel like I've seen it on all the medications. I mean, because here's another thing just to kind of think about going back to what's the number one treatment for adiposity related insulin resistance? Don't overthink this. It's caloric reduction, right?
So right.
The second you create an energy deficit, you improve insulin sensitivity. For example, that goes all the way back to
maybe with surgery. Days. I mean, like
within when people suddenly dramatically drop it, and this goes back to old stories with when they first started doing bariatric surgery and diabetes. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the surgery. I mean, surgery helps a lot, right? It wasn't the weight loss. It was the hospital stay when they're fasting. And suddenly they didn't need as much insulin. And so the second you really get a good trigger for reducing your energy deficit, that's at least part of the contribution. I'm not saying it's the only thing, because there's God knows what else is going on. But it's immediately when you have the most powerful therapy to reduce your energy intake, you do improve insulin sensitivity right off the bat.
So maybe.
That's part of
it. That makes sense.
Part of it anyways. You know.
I've seen some things with GLP-1 and LH production and all sorts of stuff. I don't know. Is this just interesting? Dr. Lucky, did you see there is a new PCOS tirzepatide trial coming out called Periods?
I was going to say
we need these things to come out. Most of the stuff recently is like post hoc.
No,
it's retrospective stuff.
So we're going to have, I think, an explosion of data in the next like 5 to 10 years. I'm actually really excited about it. And I didn't at the beginning of my career, even in my training, anticipate how much I would be talking about insulin resistance, but now it's become a regular part of my day-to-day conversation. Totally. And I've seen it just from now becoming like a seasoned IVF expert, because you see the outcome, right? You see longitudinally when people are, if they go through multiple cycles, or I sometimes will get patients coming to me for a second opinion. And when things don't add up, one of the first questions I'm asking myself is there any way that this person has insulin resistance at play? Because if they're young and it's like, well, why didn't they had 20 eggs retrieved and only one embryo? Like all that drop off, like there's got to be something going on to explain why their egg quality or embryo quality was so poor. And so you think insulin resistance, you think of hidden sperm factors that aren't easy to assess on basic testing like a semen analysis. Those are like the two big things. And then endometriosis, those are really the most missed things. And even when it comes to failed embryo transfers or people having recurrent losses, insulin resistance is like number one on the list of things that are being missed by other specialists.
When it comes to endometriosis, what do you do for them to help overcome?
Well, it really depends, because endometriosis is a fascinating disease. It can manifest in so many different ways. No two patients with endo are going to look exactly alike or have the same manifestations. For some people, it's causing mechanical blockages, and it's just like the tubes are blocked. Let's work around it. For some people, it is very insidious. It's like infiltrating. These are basically cells that act like the inner lining of the uterus that are responsive to hormones are found in other locations that they shouldn't be. And sometimes really weird cases, like they can be in the C-section scar, they can be in the brain, in the lung cavity.
Lungs, where they're throwing up blood once a month.
Yeah, or having a relapsed lung with every period. I mean, those are like the really rare cases. Most often, it's like location, location, location. It's going to be in the pelvic cavity, right? And a lot of people think of it as kind of an immune mechanism because all of us probably have some level of retrograde menstruation. Well, not all of us on this call, but anyone who menstruates probably has some degree of retrograde menstruation. But my immune system is able to recognize those cells as foreign and come in and kind of clean them up like a janitor. And they have invasive properties because think about the purpose of the uterine lining. It's to allow an embryo to implant. There's a lot of stickiness and ability to adhere to things and a lot of angiogenesis, which is a fancy word for being able to create new blood cells out of thin air. And basically that allows them to set up shop and create these implants. And the more ovulations you have and estrogen exposure, the more they grow and they're growing. And then there's a withdrawal of the hormones and you can get really bad pain and inflammation and you can get adhesions. So depending on how it's manifesting, some of them manifest in the ovary as a big cyst that takes up space and it is depleting the egg count and the follicles and, you know, just destroying the ovary slowly over time. It's a really destructive disease. And then there are people that have it really, you know, stage four, stage three, and they don't have infertility. That's the mysterious part, is that not everyone with endometriosis will have infertility, but there's certainly a much higher rate of endometriosis in the population of patients with infertility. So there's a huge association. I think the hardest manifestation that I deal with is really severe cases of adenomyosis, which is where endometriosis is infiltrating the muscle of the uterus, and that can cause a lot of issues with implantation. So the solve for it, to answer your question, depends on how it manifests. And usually it means some level of fertility treatment, whether it's that laid-back treatment approach we talked about, which is like essentially like speed dating for the reproductive tract, getting you to ovulate more than one egg, delivering sperm closer to those eggs, and just hoping that a meeting is more likely to take place. And there's a wide range of reasons of why that can be helpful, but it's really like gambling. It's like, well, if you release more than one egg, there's a better chance that one of them is going to get past all those hurdles.
Back to the lucky egg.
Exactly.
It's the lucky egg.
Yeah, you understand. Or IVF, I think, is very effective for endo for a lot of patients because you're taking this process of turning eggs into embryos outside of that inflammatory environment. So it makes sense, but sometimes it's not a solve. Sometimes you see cases where you're like, despite our best efforts, there's a lot of attrition outside of the body when the eggs are being turned into embryos because there's an inherent egg quality issue. So to answer your question, it's different for different people. And the way we treat it and approach it has to be tailored according to the type of endometriosis and their situation.
Love it. Well, that's the end of our hour. Everybody,
thank you. I have one important question, though. When we post this, would it be okay if we played the Britney Spears Lucky Song?
Oh, I would love that. Yes. I would love that. Yes.
No, we're definitely going to have to do that.
I went on a talk show in Canada that actually Jen Gunter has been on called The Social. It's like their version of The View. And I walk out and they never told me they were going to do this, but they played this song from the 80s, Madonna. It's called Lucky Star.
Yeah.
And I remember listening to it when I was like 3 or 4 and my sister would always play it for me. She's 10 years older than me. And it had such a weird psychological effect because I didn't anticipate it. And all of a sudden I'm out there like trying to get my game face on and I feel like I'm 3 years old again. And I'm like, oh my God, like, this is very disturbing.
Trying to concentrate, like, okay, get my,
it was
get my
so
mind
funny.
Back in.
But that Britney Spears, I would be much more mentally prepared and attuned for.
Very cool.
Yes, very good. Well, anybody listening, make sure you share this with a friend, family member, anybody else who is thinking about fertility or wants to know about good evidence-based information around fertility. And make sure you pick up a copy of The Lucky Egg. We'll have it in the show notes if you want. But just honestly, Google Lucky Egg. Thanks for so much for coming on. And also, she's on Instagram. Follow her. Is that where you're at mostly? Instagram and where else?
At lucky.seekon, S-E-K-H-O-N. I'm on TikTok too. TikTok as well under Dr. Lucky Egg.
Dr. Lucky Egg. Thanks so much. Also, make sure you give us a 5 out of 5. Helps us with the ratings. If it's not 5, get the hell out of here. Here is our outro. Thanks so much for coming on, Dr. Lucky.
Thank you for having me.